Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm Jeremy Kinsman. I'm kind of a zealot here, a zealot facing the Mount Rushmore of North American diplomacy. Two giants, the best diplomats. I can say this because I worked for one and with the other. Of their generation, and I can say of adjacent generations. And both of them, I tell you, are missed today. But they're with us. About 30 years ago, when I worked for Allen in Washington, as many of us did, happily, great years, one night he said, "Listen, come over for a drink. There's an extraordinary American coming through town. He's their ambassador to Israel, and he's going on, lucky guy, to El Salvador." And that's when I met Tom Pickering. And they, Alan and Tom, had been friends from, I guess, your first postings to the United Nations in Geneva in the 1950s. I want to just mention that Tom really had to stretch to get here today. He got here literally today, I think at 3 o'clock this morning, so we're doubly grateful. Tom Pickering is a remarkable man. I watched Tom in Moscow, and I saw how a great global power can have an ambassador that actually really affects positively what can happen in a country. He's a person from whom people expect outcomes. And when he left government a decade ago, after the Clinton administration, Tom did something quite unusual. He went to work for America's totemic export corporation, Boeing, and he set up for them a foreign service. And I tell you, you can track Boeing's fortunes, and its challenge to Airbus sales dominance, successful challenge, from about that very moment. And I hope you got stock. Tom is a strategic thinker. Those of you who, like me, read the wonky publications, the New York Review of Books, Foreign Affairs, will have seen that Tom has been the constant voice of advocacy in the essays over the last 5 years, advocating a nuclear build-down, which, not coincidentally, has become a centerpiece of the Obama foreign policy. He is many things today, but to me, very significantly, he is American co-chair of the advocacy and action NGO that I think is the most effective in the world, the International Crisis Group. Alan, of course, is no slouch as a strategic thinker either. I don't know, Alan, if you, do you know that Alan is an alumnus of this university? Nobody has mentioned that. That's what's made him the wild and crazy radical anti-establishment figure he is today. After several, after being here, Harvard, Oxford, Alan achieved international renown as an international legal scholar. And that knowledge, I can testify, I witnessed, gave him unrivaled access in Washington for a foreign ambassador. And with that access, I think for an ambassador, unrivaled influence. That influence was buttressed to a great extent by the profile in Washington of Alan's wife, Sandra, whom I know is back there somewhere, whose well-read satirical column in the Washington Post had many readers on Capitol Hill who were happy to open the door to the ambassador. But Alan's influence came mainly from the fact that he had something of interest to say to Americans about the world. Bob Leegvold had a book review in Foreign Affairs, the current version, Alan, about Bob Ford, the legendary Canadian, 14-year Canadian ambassador in Moscow. There's been a biography that's come out on him. And Leegvold said that U.S. readers overlook foreign figures, however powerful their insights. And he lamented how great the resulting loss. Well, U.S. leaders weren't permitted to overlook Alan Gottlieb, who argued 25 years ago for an historic free trade agreement with the U.S., and he won that strategic argument, which brings us to the crux of the issues before this conference. And our hope is that this conversation now will, this keynote conversation, can be the setup for what follows among you. Tom, you're the master globalist, sent as America's ambassador wherever there was big time trouble, wherever the best was called for. In the Middle East, ambassador in Jordan and Israel. As I said, war-torn El Salvador. You went to the UN at the end of the 90s in that brief window when it actually worked, when the Russians cooperated into the early 90s. And then you were in, of course, Moscow itself for almost 4 years, as I recall, as well as India. And Alan, whereas Tom was sent to a host of critical places by his country with its global reach, Canada's only got one border. So you became Canada's longest-serving ambassador to Washington, where you were needed most. You each had the top professional job in your respective foreign ministries. Tom was Undersecretary for Political Affairs under Bill Clinton, and Alan was Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, an advisor and provocateur of several prime ministers, including one who is among us today, Joe Clark. But in their jobs, they had different emphases. Tom, at his desk, looked out at the world, and I don't think very often toward Canada. Alan's gaze was necessarily on the world. Canada's an internationalist country. But most critically, his focus was on Washington and what happens to Canada there. So what I want to see in this conversation is if these two heroes of North American diplomacy can bridge the global dimension and the continental dimensions to see if there is some mutual reinforcement between those two dimensions in relevance. So, question to you, Alan, Ambassador Gottlieb. You described a few years ago transcendent U.S. power as the dominant feature of the contemporary order. Well, we all did, but today U.S. prospects economically are, of course, depleted. 9/11 was a huge setback for North American integration. The U.S. is obsessed with its own protection, physical security, as well as economic protectionism. Do you think economic integration is past its high water mark now? Is a grand strategy that you have called for still thinkable?
Very good questions, Jeremy. Very good questions. And before I try to respond, can I just say what a pleasure it is for me to be sharing this little platform, these chairs, with Tom Pickering. It's true we began our careers about the same time, 122 years ago. And what I remember best about Tom, I mean, everybody remembers his brilliance. I mean, he was the third secretary at the bottom of the poll, but he clearly was outstanding. But what I really remember about him, we used to travel on the French countryside and have lunch, and I remember, and I'm sure my wife remembers, the man has had a prodigious appetite. The extent of a sortie into a great three-star restaurant at that time, the greatest in France, called the Pyramide, when he ate so much cheese that he had to resort to the vomitorium in the back. Sorry about Tom, but that's what happens when you go back a long way. I'm sure you've obliterated that from your mind. So, on to less serious matters. My answer to your question is the era or the possibilities of a grand bargain of further integration. Is it, does it lie behind us rather in front of us? I regret to say very much that I fear it lies behind us. I wouldn't rule it out completely. Nothing, everything changes in life and the world. But at this time, I'd have to say that I have a clouded view of the future of our relationship. It is very good relationship now. I mean, there's, the points of friction are very limited. But when you look to the future, I don't know where we are going, actually. And I think for Canada, it's one of the most critical questions for our country and for the prosperity and flourishing of our country. When I think that I don't live in Washington anymore and I don't have the access to thinkers that I do, but I worry that there is a lack of strategic view of Canada in Washington, in the administration. You're not going to find it in the Congress. I feel a sense that there's a lack of a sense of the importance and the role of Canada in terms of United States national interest. In my career, which spanned a half a century off and on of dealing with the United States, I believe that we had a special relationship. These are very old-fashioned words today, and I apologize for them, but there it is. And Jeremy said I should try to be provocative. But we did have a special relationship, which was forged in the two great capital events of the last century, World War II and the Cold War. And the United States had a strategic view of Canada, and that we were an essential partner in the Cold War, as in World War II and the Cold War. And the result of that, and I think the history books will show this, if one does the homework, that we did have a special relationship. And the United States, on a number of occasions, subordinated its economic interests to its geopolitical interests. Our real estate was seen as critical during the Cold War. And at least a half a dozen occasions, the United States, I think, treated Canada pas comme les autres, not like the others. We were, a relationship in that sense was exceptional. Among the examples, one could even talk about the Auto Pact, which was basically a U.S. idea, I believe, and which would never, ever have seen the day without U.S. influence and GATT and the multilateral fora to produce a unique relationship in Canada. With Canada. And if you go down a whole series, which I could talk about, the United States did not treat Canada calmly, so maybe we were annoying at times and provocative, but we had a special relationship. Since the end of the Cold War, in the era, the relatively brief era, let's say, where the notion, consensus was there's only one great superpower, to today, I don't think that sense of specialness exists anymore. And I don't sense that there is a strategic view in the United States of the importance of Canada. I think Canada is now in a difficult position looking forward, although relations are not bad, in that we are deeply integrated with the U.S. economy, but we're not completely integrated. And we're seeing the consequence of, I think, the most significant event in our relationship in the last 50 years, namely 9/11. And the United States has deliberately and consciously set about recreating the border or reinventing the border. And that is something which is deeply, deeply alien to the notion of the special relationship we have and to the integration of our two economies. And I don't know where it's going to end. I see Homeland Security as an enormously vigorous engine driving its agenda to the point of infinity, because there's never any total security, as we know from reading all about airlines. And without a strategic vision of the importance of Canada to the United States interests, I think we're going to see a chipping away, and we're going to see a interference with the functioning of our two economies, because it does function on the basis of no border. We weren't involved just in exports among each other, but, you know, in joint manufacturing, the border was disappearing. And yet we had the Secretary of the Interior, Janet Neapolitano, and she made a great speech about a year ago, which said that, well, we need a real border. We don't need any kind of make-believe border. We want a real border. And I think a real border is incompatible with further integration, and it's incompatible with seeing where we are. Is there any possibility that the United States will see a strategic relationship with Canada in the future? Possibly. I don't see it in the Congress. I don't see any visionaries in the Congress. In my time, there were many, at least a half a dozen congressmen and senators who had a vision of North America and who were critical in the success of the free trade agreement. Senators Moynihan, Senator Bradley, Congressman Gibbons, a whole group who were key players in achieving that historic agreement. I don't see that in the Congress today. I don't see any sign of it. And frankly, if it's in the White House, I would be surprised. I don't see it. And so energy is the one area where you could argue that the United States does have a deeply strategic interest in Canada. And I believe that. But I don't sense that is the view in Washington. I don't sense it. And I think the environmentalists and the special interests are running the agenda. So that's my reaction to you.
Tom, you may want to respond to that, but I'll just remind you of something you wrote recently about the U.S. and Canada having the potential to become what you call the project model of environmental cooperation, which is a form of strategic thinking. Can you postulate areas in which the United States would be able to seize upon the idea of Canada being an integral part of American strategic thinking?
Jeremy, let me say two things at the beginning. One, what a great pleasure it is to see Alan and Sandra again after a number of years, but also to sit back and enjoy what Alan had to say. And secondly, to say that it is the height of lunacy to fly overnight, come to a meeting where everyone is a much greater expert than oneself, and then be asked to address serious questions of great moment and real depth from the basis of maximum disadvantage. Let me also thank you for your fluid flow of hyperbole in my regard, which has been the one redeeming virtue of having attended here this morning. Not that in any way any of it is believable. Let me say that both from the point of view that I remain a lunatic optimist and from the perspective of the fact that opportunities are real and there, not that necessarily everyone is moving rapidly to pick them up. I'd like to talk against the backdrop of Alan's somewhat muted and careful pessimism toward the direction in which I think we need to go and where the opportunities rest. There is no question at all that not everyone in Washington awakes every morning saying, now what can I do together with Canada? That may not be true in Ottawa in the reverse sense, but it is there. But I would begin by saying that the absence of strategic vision on Canada may well be a mirror image of what I think is the search for strategic vision in the United States for the long term, for the future. And that in many ways, this is characterized against a backdrop where we tried force as a substitute for diplomacy. It didn't work very well. Where we thought we had a unilateral moment, but I don't believe there was ever a unilateral moment defined in terms of what the United States could do anywhere in the world what it wanted and get away with it. That in fact, we live in a multilateral world. That Canada is a very important piece of that. That there are still geographic strategic concerns of interest, maybe not as strong as they were at the height of the Cold War, but they're there. There are energy relationships, and there are indeed a number of other things that we can do. I don't disagree with Alan on the notion that Washington is immediately wrestling with the serious problem of the future. But let me just postulate a few things and try to get to your second question as well. I think 9/11 did bring the hunker down factor to the United States in a very severe way. I think, however, this now raises the question for us of, is the real border, the peripheral arrangements that Canada and the United States could jointly make together, or is it that line that runs down the middle? And I think we have an opportunity to work together in the peripheral arrangements. Now, it is true that very few people in Canada share the vision of homeland security, but homeland security is not the entire U.S. government, and we all know that the finest homeland security is to do away with all trade and all movement of people. Then we have perfect homeland security. And we all know that that is an absolutely lunatic version. We all know that we have an opportunity as two people, if I could say this, separated by a common accent, to operate together in a way that can produce a North American commons that can take the disadvantage of 9/11 and turn it into an operational possibility that could move us ahead. And I think one of the things that we ought to do is to think about our common border. People smarter than I tell me that we have miserable facilities on the American side. I won't comment on Canada. People have told me for years that the tightening of the border is a huge problem, and I agree. The fact that I need a passport to go to Canada, not that I didn't have one, is an additional irritant. But what if we could think about a progress over a period of years where instead of renewing our facilities individually, separated by 100 yards of parking lot, we thought about doing something quite unusual internationally, having a common facility, having a common arrangement where you entered and exited at the same time, having an arrangement over a period of time where you didn't care what color uniform the guy was wearing or the woman was wearing, but they actually performed the duties on behalf of both states in a way that represented a common sense of what it was requiring to get back and forth because we had developed a perimeter about which we could agree on terms. Now, that is the hard part. But my feeling is that it is well worthwhile taking a look at this opportunity and beginning what I would call quiet conversations about not how we can homeland securitize the United States, but how we could agree on a common approach to this issue. The environment, in my view, holds the same opportunities. For years, we have been wrestling with trans-border pollution. That's the beginning of substance, and we have actually made some progress. As indeed, I am told, we have made progress on softwood and Buy America. Not that we have a perfect answer, but my feeling is the fact that in those very hard issues, we can make progress through hard work and understanding means that we can on the environment. I think that our energy interrelationship and indeed the growing dependence of the United States upon an energy, and it's not just tar sands oil, it is oil and gas, it is transit of oil and gas from Alaska, it is hydroelectric power in the east, where a serious drought in Quebec could produce problems for all of us. It is the joint management of our grids, where we saw, in fact, that we could each bring each other down in a way that makes it inevitable that we work together on those kinds of issues, where if we have the ability, and I think the Obama administration has opened the door to that, both on climate change and the environment, which are deeply impactful domestically in both of our countries, that we could move again to find answers that would pull us together. And that's what I meant by a joint project. So I think that what I've said on borders, what I have said about perimeters, what I have said about the environment raise those questions. Now, let me raise one other issue, because I know it's deeply pertinent to both of us. We have Arctic transportation as well as Arctic environment to think about together, and they're conjoined. My own feeling is that, and I don't represent anybody but myself, it is absolutely lunatic to question the notion of Canadian sovereignty over a body of water in which maybe 6 or 8 or 10 foreign ships have actually passed in the full life, And where the first passage was the RCMP vessel Saint-Roch in the 1930s. But it is useful for the two of us to think about the future and to think about, can we together, from the Davis Straits, which happen to be international, to the Bering Straits, which happen to be international, confect together arrangements for appropriate ship construction and standards, for international safety in ice, through provision of ice-breaking services, perhaps jointly, through SAR, search and rescue, through the protection of the local environment, through aids to navigation, come together on a situation which in no way questions Canadian sovereignty over a piece of that, but in no way questions the internationalization or the international character of some of those waterways. And in my view, that double-ended approach could lead us to an agreement, even a treaty, that could then become the project standard for the rest of the Arctic and maybe even Antarctic transportation, if that ever becomes a necessity. So we have a joint capacity to move there. And you said you only have one border. Well, you've got a border with Denmark or Greenland, depending upon how you want to do it. And increasingly, you will have some kind of EEZ interaction with Russia, Norway, perhaps, and others. So we need to think about that. Arctic oil and how to approach that is something we ought to work on together, because we have a lot of experience and we have joint interests in that area. So the Arctic, in my view, is another area where we can move, and it naturally grows out of the cooperation we had even before the dew line on cooperative weather stations, and after the dew line on North American defense, and now with NORAD and our Northern Command and Canadian cooperation. So let me stop there and say that the strategic vision may be lacking and indeed bleak, but the tactical opportunities are great. And the reality is that as America is no longer the unrivaled fable of the world's largest hegemon, but is in fact a part of a multilateral and indeed multinational world, we are going to need cooperation with Canada even more, but we can constructively use Canada's experience in some of these areas as an additional source of information, and indeed as an additional source of moving ahead. The project cannot be one way. It cannot be an American project in which Canadians are a minor partner. There has to be two-way street. Otherwise, we get into the most difficult question of sitting up here and being totally patronizing, and that's not what I would propose.
Tom, thanks. That's very rich. And Dr. Franklin Griffiths will be talking about the Arctic later. Can I tell an anecdote about Ambassador Gottlieb? Apropos of the Arctic, once in about 1982 or 83, the ambassador called me in and said, "Jeremy, you know, I think they're reading our telegrams." This was when we were talking about some fairly sensitive stuff. Pierre Trudeau was Prime Minister of Canada, not beloved in Washington. He said, "I'm convinced they're reading our telegrams." And he said, "Listen, here's what we're going to do. You're going to write a telegram that's going to drive the Americans insane, okay? It's going to be something. What is it going to be? I'll tell you what it's going to be. Send a telegram saying that Ottawa's decision to draw straight baselines in the Arctic, okay, is going to be deeply controversial in Washington. And I bet you that the cocktail parties I'm going to go to for the rest of the week, they're going to come up to me and tell me, we know what's going on." So I wrote the telegram. We sent the telegram. In those days, you had, you know, clerks who typed these things out in code and all that. And we went off to cocktail parties, sort of saying, "Hi, hello, how are things?" Of course, there wasn't a peep. There wasn't a peep. And then, of course, we concluded darkly that they had the room bugged, you know. But
the fact that it wasn't a peep just proves that they were reading our stuff.
That's right.
They didn't want to blow their cover.
That's right. But anyway, just to say that these issues of the Arctic have always been neuralgic, and what Ambassador Pickering is proposing, of course, is a way to work together in a common project. Let me take up another point you made, Tom, and ask both of you something. Alan mentioned the Auto Pact. As I recall, The Ottawa Pact was signed by Lyndon Johnson, partly, and he did it expeditiously, because Canada had responded to the United States' request to put 2,500 peacekeepers into Cyprus to try and put an end to that war between two NATO allies. And the point of that is that sometimes you mentioned Canada's contribution to America's role this time. In fact, you've written, if I may quote you, Tom, "There has not been a better time since World War II for us to work together with Canada with its different vision and its long and varied experience." You mentioned the place of diplomacy in multilateral consultation just now. Do you think that these conditions enhance Canada's so-called value proposition to the United States? So I would ask you, do you see that Canada, in a complementary way now, has, even though the Cold War has ended, has even greater value to bring to bear and thereby get the political capital and leverage and attention in Washington that's missing? And then, Alan, I guess I'd ask you, is Canadian foreign policy up to it? But, Tom...
Well, I think, Jeremy, look, let's not wallow in hyperbole. Let's be realistic. There is a huge effort on the part of the United States and the Obama administration to deal with a wide number of issues at hand. But I think there is an opportunity, given the wide number of issues at hand, for Canada to play both a constructive, but I would say perhaps challenging role in getting the U.S. to look at a set of issues that not just reflect Canadian domestic priorities, but over the years I've always admired the fact that Canada can have domestic priorities and foreign policy interests at the same time. The United States one is always supplemented to the other. And so that, in that sense, you have perhaps the opportunity with fewer global preoccupations to think more. And that has been, from the early days, a very useful piece. I remember, just as an aside, years ago, you began to reform your foreign service before we thought it was necessary. And we took a lesson from that and began to copy, emulate, borrow, steal, and indeed use a number of the things that you dealt with. You know, working wives was just one example. But those are small things, but they have the illustrative character of saying that over a period of time, you haven't been at least tortured by the wide number of things we have. The second thing is that you have tended to specialize in some areas. Certainly we mentioned peacekeeping a while ago. I mean, no American would sit here today and also say that Canada's military role has been limited to peacekeeping and understand what you have been doing in Afghanistan and Haiti. And that's totally subliminal in most of the United States, which is a tragedy in many ways, in some way needs to be found to push that forward. But one possibility is, and it's been suggested to me, that, and you'll talk about trilateralism later, but over a period of time, we could both find ways to help the Mexicans, particularly you, because we are not persona grata in a military sense in Mexico and won't be for some time, but the Mexican military is struggling. Some of that can be with the integration of military and law enforcement, which is preeminently a peacekeeping issue. Another piece might well be, over time, to get the Mexicans to look at something that they haven't looked at for years, which is peacekeeping, and how and in what way they might play a role and move ahead. But dealing with them now on their challenge of drugs and terror is something that we both need to think about. Because while we are a formidable barrier to the migration of all of that, tied together as we are, we both have a long-term interest in seeing where that can go. And your special character, and indeed over time, the independence that Canada has created living under the shadow of the elephant, is a useful approach tool and mechanism where you are not threatening, but knowledgeable and valuable. So I think those kinds of things can work. Now, I ventured a little bit away from your question, but I do think that there are special qualities that can be put in. The second question is, can you feed those into the maw in Washington? I have a sense that the Obama administration is much more open to this than the Bush administration was. The Bush administration might have been open to chummy meetings and particularly good press conferences, but it was not open to operational activities. The Obama administration is theoretically open to operational activities. One of its big problems is to operationalize anything. But it doesn't necessarily mean you are any worse off than anybody else. And I think to some extent building that up. I would say one thing finally. If the two countries are serious about moving ahead, it's not just the presidential and prime ministerial meeting. But if I were dealing with this, I would go find somebody in or out of the administration on both sides who could work quietly together as the personal representatives of the two leaders, totally subliminal, and spend time talking about the plethora of opportunities and how we could deal with those, not just reflecting what is the current day neuralgia, but what is it in the space of 5 years the two of us could work on together that would have a win-win quality to it. So it's not just the relief of the current boil on the flesh, but it is an opportunity, if I could put it with, to strengthen the muscles and sinews of the relationship, and to do it on the basis that this would not only be good for the two of us, it would be good for the trilateral, but it could have some useful demonstrative effect elsewhere around the world. And this would be that kind of relationship which would change geography from the Cold War into what I would call intellect in the current day and age, which I will not characterize by an epithet.
Alan, could you take that on? And let me just, in addressing two things, Canada's possibility of using foreign policy initiatives, the fact that we have created a combat-ready army that is leaving Afghanistan, beaten up, but a considerable asset to deploy on behalf of common purposes, but also taking up Tom's point that that Canada's transformation of diplomacy of was something that you watched. You were the inventor of public diplomacy, and you have always said that Canada's problems at the end of the day weren't successive administrations anyway. They were in Congress, which in making domestic policy was making foreign policy for Canada. So can you take those two different things on and...
Well, I've got it sort out of my mind. There's so many interesting and provocative thoughts floating here, but can I just focus on two points? Just, if I may, going back to Tom's first remarks, I agree with you that there are opportunities for these joint projects. They are great opportunities. The Arctic is one. The development of a common continental security approach, simply an outer security perimeter. There's all kinds, I think, of potential in terms of energy. I just, forgive me for saying, but I can't imagine how the U.S. does not think, how it could not think strategically about our energy. We have in our, all we hear from the United States and Washington is about dirty oil. That's what we hear. And you've got from Hollywood to the corridors of Congress. We could easily be producing 5 million barrels a day from the dirty oil sands, which are not anywhere near so dirty as they say. United States consumes, what, 20 million barrels a day? It imports, what, 10? If it had, we have in Canada one customer at the present time, the United States. If within 5 years or 7 years, 50% of their imports could come from Canada, it would transform and revolutionize the geopolitics of the United States' national interests, because it would transform the dependency on Middle Eastern oil. Do I hear anybody talking about it or thinking about it? No. So what I wanted to say, and I think it's an important point, those projects are there. But they're not going to happen, I think, without some strategic vision, some sense of the importance of the relationship and its potential. And that's why I think we are simply not moving anywhere. We've had this security and prosperity partnerships, and we've had discussions for years on what Buffalo Bridge and a Detroit Bridge, and it goes nowhere. It goes, the rest of it goes nowhere. It goes into the bowels of the special interest and congressional lobbies. So on the other, that's why I'm not optimistic about it, but I agree. I agree with you completely if that could be done. If it's going to be done, somehow the signal has to come from the top. There's got to be, including the notion of two special envoys, which I think is a great idea, to look at opportunities. The signal's got to come from the top, and we know that Mr. President Obama's plate is awfully full, but he's not the first president with a full plate. And in the past, we did move things together. On the question of Canadian foreign policy, can we contribute? You know, United States, they get up in the morning, they're not going to say what's new in Canada. But there has been a long tradition of respect for Canadian insights and Canadian diplomacy. And I just want to respond, Jeremy. You mentioned Ambassador Ford in your remarks, a Canadian ambassador in Moscow for some 15 years. Let me tell you this anecdote. One day in Washington, the word came out, George Shultz is appointed Secretary of State. Al Haig's out, George Shultz is in. Well, 4 or 5 days later, I'm sitting in my office at 1746 Mass Avenue, and my secretary says, Secretary Shultz is on the line, he wants to talk to you. Well, that just blew me over. I thought maybe he was inquiring about the health of his old friend John Turner, but he said, Ambassador, I'd like to ask you a favor. I said, sir, what can I do? He said, I understand that your former ambassador to Moscow, who had just retired, is probably the greatest expert on the Soviet Union on this planet. And I would like to spend several hours with him. And I wonder if there's any way you could bring him to Washington to meet with me and some of my chief advisors. Well, I said, just absolutely not. Anyway, I won't skip all the details about the difficulty of persuading Ottawa to pay for his ticket and why he'd be coming to Washington while he was living in France at the time. And the fact is, George Shultz met him. I was there, I was present. And they spent several hours talking about, because he has something to say. We have something to contribute, which means we have the resources, the human resources. Good old-fashioned word, diplomatic capacity. We had expertise, we had a different somewhat perspective, but we weren't just bloviating, we had expertise. In my time, that carried over. It might have been a diminishing product, but it carried over. I would spend with one of your predecessors, Tom, Larry Eagleburger, on Saturday mornings, at least twice a month, we would spend an hour and a half or two together. And we would talk about the trouble spots, and he wanted to know not what I was thinking, but what Canada was thinking. So we could play a role dealing with the agenda of the United States and Canada, and I think the requirement for that is going to increase because we are moving into a world, I believe the world, it's not going to be a new international order. We're moving into the world of the resurrection of the old international order, namely of sovereign states pursuing national interests. We hear BRIC, BRIC, BRIC. What does BRIC mean? It means a recognition of the emergence of powerful, important, growing states in a world that is more complex and where the national interest is pursued by the Indias, by the Chinas, by the Brazils. What does that mean? If you're going to be able to contribute to intelligent policy formation, you have to have experts, knowledge, and you've got to make the investment. We've not been making the investment in Canada. We have, to get into the problem of washing our own laundry, but I think in terms of that investment, it's been diminishing for a decade.
So, we have been running down our capital. Let me ask you a subjective question.
that's difficult, but it's one that everybody is concerned with in this conference. Ronald Reagan had a view, Alan, you'll remember. It was a kind of an innocent view, but it was a view that there was a North American community, that somehow it was a something, okay? It was different. What was it called?
Common North American
Home. And it was a home for the peoples of North America, as distinct to other places in the world. Do you see that that community having today any kind of resonance outside North America? Or do you think it's always going to be seen as being the dominant United States on the one hand, and then the other North America of Canada and Mexico on the other hand, to some extent in the shadow of America's near abroad? Is there something that North America, you talked about an exemplary model, has to show the rest of the world? Let me ask you that.
Yeah, I think that we do in an interesting way. I made the points, but let me take it one step further. On trade. We've had our trade problems. We'll continue to have trade problems. It's, in my view, for us to move trade problems to a more robust arbitral process in which we agree that the end result of a fair and clean, open arbitral process is going to be followed by both countries. Now, this would be a real advance on the WTO. The WTO has fashioned an arbitral process in which it basically says that the greatest proponent of the exercise of open markets and free trade will authorize protectionist retaliation in cases where the arbitration moves in the direction of one state or another. We could take it to the direction that the arbitral processes will be binding. And because of the trust that still exists, although it frays, each of us will be bound to carry out the result. We will try, obviously, all negotiations. And the fact of having a binding arbitral process hanging over us will empower negotiations to get an answer, which is also, in my view, useful. The second thing we have is that we have a trilingual, multicultural North America, and we tend to forget it, but anybody who lives in my part of North America has become increasingly aware of it. So we need to think about with Mexico, where I think Canada has had more or less a zero-sum jealousy, which is, in my view, totally misplaced, and where Canada has taken a new lead in the Organization of American States, and where Canada has opened up policies toward Cuba that I think are the right direction to go in. Why don't we on trade see whether the next thing that we can do is to put NAFTA next to the Central American Trade Agreement, and maybe with the Caribbean, where we both have historical and other interests. And not to open NAFTA entirely, but to see whether we can harmonize and coordinate, whether we can apply most favored nation arrangements across those two sets of trade agreements. In a broader way. That would be an example, in my view, of the power of this particular question. And for the Spanish-speaking parts of that world, we have our Mexican friends, who, when I was in Central America, used to be seen as the Colossus of the North. It was a refreshing simile for someone who had grown up with a different vision of who was the Colossus of the North. But nevertheless, it could help us in helping to open up, stabilize, and strengthen those areas where we all have a little bit of trade, but it could increase. And so there are things that we can do to outreach together, maybe beginning close to home, that could be preeminently useful. I would like to think that one of the things that Canada could be talking to us about is how to deal effectively in the future with Cuba. That would be, in my view, useful information to have, even if it wasn't totally accepted, because we have domestic problems that are legion over Cuba. But we're beginning to move in the right direction. It's going to take time. And I think that you have something to offer on that stage. So I think we've spent too little time looking to the future and too much time looking to the current impasses and too little time building on the past constructs.
That's good advice. Alan?
Well, I think we have much to regret that Tom Pickering is not political undersecretary in Washington today, because I think those are very imaginative and points. And but I remain the skeptic that I am. Nothing could affect the future of our relationships in North America more than the adoption of a compulsory arbitral binding mechanism. It's the holy grail, I think, in many ways. The chances of achieving that, you're the American, I'm not, I would say is somewhere between zero and zero minus. Just can't, not going to happen. We thought we had something. The brilliance of the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement is we did make some progress towards applying our own law. It wasn't a fraud. It was significant, but it was very far off from. And we took tremendous leadership on the part of Ronald Reagan, Jim Baker. That whole they overruled their lawyers. They faced court challenges. They did it for strategic and for grand reasons. Ronald Reagan, he may not have known it, but he had a strategic view of Canada, and he had a strategic view of North America, and he stuck to it. And everybody on his team had that vision because it was his vision. Your other point, Jeremy, about if we actually formed a single, shall we say, economic space in North America, if we were to remove the border as an obstacle, if we were to have compulsory arbitration, and we were to move into a North American community, would the world see the partners at the margin, Canada and Mexico, as simply in U.S. shadow, or would they have a credibility, retain their credibility? I think that's the wrong way, if I may say, to think about Canada. Leave aside Mexico, but I believe it's true there too. I think the world sees Canada and Mexico as significant countries. And I think it's our own sense of vulnerability and weakness beside the super colossal giant of the United States that makes people think that maybe we're a midget, but we're not. And it's impossible, I think, to travel and to deal with issues outside our country without recognizing that Canada, and this is not boastful, but it's not foolish. We're seen as a significant player with a lot to contribute. Mexico, likewise. These, you know, we talked about the role of sovereign states and the reinvention of the 19th century globe. Well, and the BRICS and things of that sort. Canada and Mexico's influence is going to grow. It will grow if our economies prosper, if we resolve our domestic issues. Canada is a good story. And I think we are, you know, it's terrible to, terribly dangerous ground, because Canadians do have a habit of congratulating themselves. And I think it's better to be self-critical than self-congratulatory. But we shouldn't, I think, underestimate the standing we have. And I think a North American community in that sense, some kind of overarching identity, would not diminish Canada and Mexico in the eyes of the world. And would, I think, if our economy, if our countries are successful, it would enhance it.
Thanks. Any last words, Tom, that you'd like to leave your colleagues with? I want to thank you enormously for thinking out loud. You may have come in at 3 in the morning, and you may feel you've done extraordinarily, both of you, and we're very, very grateful. Anything you want to wrap up?
No, I think that first, too few of these kinds of events are held. Secondly,
may I just interject? They're quite often held in Canada, but rarely in the United States.
That may be true, but you lock it up as a national treasure then.
All right.
I think that secondly, in that same sequence, our governors have gotten together for quite some time.
Yes.
We need to find a way to put pins in their backsides and see if we can move that piece ahead. I think it would be useful to expand. Some have even suggested that maybe our southern border governors could come together to share lessons learned and problems not shared to move the question ahead a little bit, and that would be helpful. I think that we need to build constituencies, and so the governors ought to be matched by parliamentary pairing as much as we possibly can. We need to find a way, with the help of our Canadian friends, to have a Canadian caucus. Everybody has a caucus now. Certainly, Florida has become, what, the 12th province of Canada. If you can get out of the way of the Canadians on I-95 or I-85 or I-75 beginning in the autumn. So there are important pieces there that we share. And to some extent, the governments cannot do this alone at the federal level. So we need depth and strength to this thing. We have not portrayed the opportunities as well as we could. And I think that getting the attention of Washington is critically important as we move ahead. I've suggested a number of ideas out there. There are plenty more. And my own feeling is that it's through catalyzing these particular opportunities that we can add inspiration. NAFTA didn't come out of a theoretical agreement. It came out of wisdom of Allen and a practical opportunity. And somehow we need to move ahead that way. But I think it's there, and I think it can be done. I think it can be done in a way that preserves our individual cultures and interests, while at the same time creates what I would call different visions of a North American commons in different areas as we move ahead. And I think this is enormously successful. And finally, it can help in places where countries get along less well together in a common region, but can look ahead at this as a model, just as they are often looking at the European Community or Union as a model, or they're looking at other regional arrangements as a model. So my sense, we had a lot to contribute, and thank you again, both of you, for giving me the opportunity to join with you today.
Thank you, our friend.
Well, concluding remarks, I think that the point Tom is making is important, engagement of the governors, engagement of many of the players. I certainly believe this to be a very important part of our relationship, and I'd like to think that I helped pioneer this. I talked about the need in our relationship for a multiplicity of instruments. Having said all that, let me observe that these are powerful forces that could be harnessed and they could be very helpful. But without the top leadership from the top, I don't think in itself all those contacts and all those relationships will yield that much value other than a feeling of goodwill. Your leadership needs to come from the top. And that is not only true in the United States, it's true in Canada. So there has to be a goal and there has to be a vision. Then the strength of the United States and Canada in our diversity and our centers, regional centers of power, in our diversity of players, these can be harnessed to overcome obstacles, to engage in trade-offs, to make deals. They can become a powerful and political force. But without the commitment, the vision at the top, we're going to see, we're not going to see much progress in our relationship, and I fear we will see some deterioration.
Well, we have had some leadership here today, and I'd like to thank these two remarkable professionals.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.